I am Jenny Jackson Adams, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Finley Williamson and also Heidi for inviting me here, and as well as Dave Froberg and any of you who had anything to do with this, because it's exciting to be here and certainly an honor in many, many ways. And also, I'm sure, an amusement and an amazement to God as well. And I want to thank John and Marilyn C., who are here from Macon. And I know they've come here with Heather and Elizabeth to support me today, and I appreciate that so much. Please, if you will, it occurred to me while walking through the hallway here that I would like to dedicate whatever I say this morning to the memory of my beloved friend and brother, C. Duncan Cater, M.D., Dr. Duncan Cater. Well, you know, they say if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know he's had some help. And that's sort of my story in a nutshell. But I want to tell my story, and I don't do this frequently. I do a lot of speaking, but usually not about me. And so it's every time I come up on it, it's very awesome to me because it seems so contradictory. My story's hard to tell. It's full of a lot of contradictions, and it's full of frustration and stagnation. It's also full of joy. It's full of hope. It's full of a lot of that, full of fear. So it's hard to tell to me, but my first sponsor in this program told me that I must tell it. And this was when I had been sober for about 2 to 3 months that she said, get up now, it's time for you to tell this. And I was really trembling then, and in a sense I still do, but I'm to strain every nerve I have to tell this, because every time I tell it, I get a little bit farther along on the learning curve, I'm told. And also, every time I tell it, I realize, in a sense, it is the only story I have, you know? And so if I don't tell it, there's something that remains kind of unfulfilled and that should be done. Well, I had a good start. Let me start there. I had a great start in life. And I know people in this program who are extremely dear to me and whom I admire and respect that did not have a good start in life. So I'm like the speaker last night. I didn't have any models for this. To fall into this disease. I really had a good start in life. As a senior minister of a large church, I can tell you a lot of people wind up in my office and say, you know, I believe in Planned Parenthood. I just didn't get the parents that I planned on getting. You know, and I'm not an example of that. A lot of people, our humor, I think, in our society conveys that. Jackie Vernon said, my father took me aside one day and left me there, you know. I went out to the Army, was gone 3 years, came back, he said, well, how was the movie? You know, we have people who just don't have any ties with each other. Zsa Gabor says, I was a great housekeeper. Every time I leave a man, I keep the house, you know. This kind of stuff goes on in our world, and we have these loose, almost no ties together. And I want to say, you know, that wasn't my experience. My parents loved one another. Neither one of them drank. They loved me. They wanted me. Neither set of grandparents drank. I am the fourth generation of Methodist ministers on one side of my family. So, I mean, I didn't have any models for this, and I was cared for, I was coddled, I was kept, I was educated, and my parents were educated. They cared about educating me. I had great clothes to wear, I had not good food to eat. I don't take these things for granted anymore like I used to. I had a good start, but there was a real downside in what was going on in my childhood, too. And I recognize that today. And I don't know if you figured this out about God, you probably have, but the way I see things, that if you'll begin to notice this, just about every blessing you ever have in your life, there's going to be a downside in it somewhere, if you examine it long enough. And for every downside or tragedy that occurs to you, there will be some secret blessing in there somewhere. And so it's a very mixed package. And the farther I go on this journey, the more aware I am of what a mixture of stuff God gives us to deal with. And it's kind of like the guy that was on a plane, or he was going to be on a plane one day, and he had stopped and bought, they still sold that flight insurance, and he bought, I think, $200,000 or $300,000 of flight insurance. And then as he was approaching where he was going to get on the plane, where the plane would depart, and got to that section of the airport, he said he stopped because he saw a place to weigh himself and get a fortune, you know. So he put in his quarter and weighed himself, and out comes his fortune and says, "Your recent investment will soon pay off." You know, and this is the kind of stuff that goes on all the time in life. So what I'm saying is, although I had a lot of ups, one of the downsides and contributing factors for my childhood was that we moved a lot. And back in that day, if you were popular as a preacher, you moved a lot. And today it's just about the opposite. You do not move if you're popular. But my dad was extremely popular, and we moved about every 2 years. I know now that I paid for that in some way. You know, that I kind of lost my bearings. I did, every time we moved, you know, I had to kind of reinvent myself, and the scene kept changing. And on the other hand, though, see, here was a blessing, because I learned to meet people. I learned to meet people, and I learned how to do that. I mean, you get good at anything you practice, you know, and I got a lot of practice at that. And so there was an upside in that. They tell a story about me early in my life that the family laughs at. But this was when we lived in downtown Houston, and I was a precocious kid that they described as just marching up to people, introducing myself and interviewing people and stuff like this, which would be highly inappropriate for where we lived. Mother said she had me one day in a huge department store in downtown Texas, and she had threatened to put a harness on me because I did this kind of stuff all the time. And she panicked set in because she had turned around and I wasn't there, and security guards all over the place were looking for me, and they had looked almost an hour. And she said, "I stopped in my tracks, Jenny, because I couldn't see you, but I heard you." I had somehow, beloved, I had found the broadcasting booth in the store. And I was making an announcement. And this was my announcement, for which I got a terrible switching later. I was saying, "Jenny Jackson's mommy's lost." "Jenny Jackson's mommy's lost." You know, of all the things I've lost, I miss my mind the most, I'm telling you. But really, see, already I was proceeding in a direction, and they laugh about this, but I mean, I was proceeding out into a far country. There's another book that I deal with quite a lot in my work, and I hope you do too, that I read about somebody who went out into a far country. And I think I was already running and already doing that. I mean, Mother had come up with a rule that I didn't like, and like the prodigal son to his father, I thumbed my nose at my mother, and I began to make my way out into a far country. And I also was deflecting what was wrong with me onto her. It was she who was lost. So these are things that were going on. As I look back on it, I can see her. You know, one of the things that's scary to me about God, one of the scariest things to me about our higher power, is that he lets you do that. He allows you to. He does not keep the son from leaving. You want to leave? Have it your way. You know, I love you more than I can tell you. I love you like you were the only one here to love. I would have done everything I did, even if you had been the only one here. But if you don't want to love me back, that's your business. You know, I ask you to worship me. If you don't want to worship me, that's fine too. You know, I ask you to do these things, but if you don't want to do them, have it your way. Drink yourself to death, you're free to do it. Eat yourself to death, you're free to do it. And that's a scary thing. about God giving us that kind of radical freedom, and that's how much he loves us. He loves us so much he sets us free. You know, and I was free to go in the wrong place, and that's what I did. I mean, I tended to want to do that. And then I believe in my far country I developed some addictions, and I'm real serious about calling these addictions. And I believe that my body and everything about me knows exactly what addiction is. But these things were important to me, and they were my far country, and they were important to me in my childhood, though I was not drinking in my childhood. I think of these as addictions because, you know, addiction is always a barefaced lie. Addiction says to you, this is the easy way around the hard part. And if you buy into that, you're buying into a barefaced lie. But I bought into that. And one of my easy ways around the hard part and one of my early addictions was achievement. And I'm serious about calling it an addiction, because if I did not have these things, I felt like I was going through withdrawal. And believe me, I know what withdrawal is. And the first one was achievement. But there again, I was being defiant. My dad asked me, and I felt a calling to ministry since I was a little girl. And it was in the 50s, and he said to me once, he said, you ever thought about going into the ministry? You know, women are going to ministry in the Methodist church now. I said, Dad, you better not say that to me. I don't want to be a minister. And I didn't. I did not want to be, and I felt that, and I was resisting it from the earliest time. I wanted a career, and I happened to have a dad who believed you could do anything, and even at the age of 2 and 3 was asking me questions like, what are you going to do with your life? I thought, wow, I thought I'd just be a kid or something, you know? There was this pressure of, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? But I kind of think I drifted off into thinking that if I achieved something, see, I didn't know anything about living a day at a time, as I've had to learn the hard way. But if I achieved something, I could kind of live off the stash it, you know, and live off the supply high that it gave me. And so I wanted to achieve, and I know now that that's sort of like cotton candy. You get it in your mouth and, you know, it won't do it for you. But I tried that. I also tried people-pleasing and approval-seeking. It was an addiction for me. I wouldn't be me. I kept worrying about what you thought. And I believe one day God's going to ask each one of us, why didn't you become you? You know, we're all born originals and we want to die copies for some reason. You know, why didn't you become you? One day, if you don't, you know, there'll be a hole in the universe where you were supposed to have been. And, you know, there are two kinds of people in life, I believe. Those who believe in destiny and those who don't believe in destiny. And if you're on the side of the big book, and also this other book I'm talking about, you can read it from Genesis to the maps. And it will turn out to also be on the side of destiny. But there's something that you're supposed to do, you know, And I, instead of doing that, I was trying to get people's approval. And I felt like if I did not have their approval, I was going through withdrawal. And this takes up a lot of your time. It leaks a lot of energy, and it's full of nothing. You know, trying to get everybody's approval is a dead game. Well, and then I guess my third thing I was hooked on was perfectionism. I really believed that I could try to be perfect. And you watch people that try to do that. Because nobody is perfect. Even Moses broke the Ten Commandments in anger, and God gave him another set. But I mean, we're not perfect. And today I know that, and I can settle down with that. But at the time, I felt like I could be or was supposed to be, and so I would see a person who does this will deflect their problems off on you so they can look perfect. If somebody's telling you you're perfect today, then you better watch them. They're lying about other stuff, too. But I thought I could be perfect and got into that. Well, I was in hot water before I ever took my first drink, is all I'm saying. You know, and the expression, people are like tea bags. You never know how strong they are till they're in hot water. And I was in a lot of hot water with it, and trying to please people and thinking that a swig of prestige or a hit of people pleasing or perfectionism would do something for me, when really it was going to be an empty road. Add to this the fact that my dad died. My dad died. That was, and still is, in some sense, like a Grand Canyon for me. You know, they said the fellow that looked at the Grand Canyon the first time said, well, something must have really happened here. And that got me. That just really took me away. I loved that man. He loved me and believed in me. When he died, I just kind of lost my place. I didn't know what to do. I can talk about that today, but I couldn't talk about it then because I couldn't allow anybody to know how I felt about it. And that's why I didn't get any help. I could have gotten help if I had said something. It's my responsibility. Even though I was a kid, I could have asked. But there's still a little girl that lives inside me that says, oh, Daddy, why did you die? I had plans. You know, and I did a funeral yesterday. That's why I got here a day late. For a man who was a very prestigious attorney in my area. And his family, he has a brilliant wife, beautiful, brilliant attorney wife. And their children. And he died so cut short too. And I looked at those boys and that daughter yesterday. I mean, Friday morning. And I know what they're feeling. I know what they're feeling because their dad was such a great guy too. And so that really shut me down. I can remember as a little girl going to sleep at night and asking God to let me talk to Dad. And that was my little childhood thoughts, you know, but I didn't want anything to do with God. And man, I was mad about this. I mean, I felt like now I know who God is. He's fundamentally untrustworthy. And these people, and I continue to go to church in my family, there'd been a lot of fallout if I hadn't done that. You know, but I would sit there in the pew, and I remember looking around at people and thinking, oh, if you only knew what I knew. You're being made a fool of. Because this God, I mean, there is a God, and I still thought there was one, some kind of cosmic intelligence that kept this whole show moving along. But he wasn't personally involved with me. Or he wouldn't have taken my dad. My dad gave him his whole life. He just sucked him up. I thought, I don't want anything to do with you. So, I mean, I just shut down spiritually. And I know today, you know, there's unity in life, sick and well. Your body, mind, and spirit. And if you get disarranged and you don't have a spiritual life, then it's going to affect your body. If you don't take care of your body, it's going to affect you spiritually. If you don't take care of yourself mentally, it's going to affect you spiritually. I mean, we're just put together that way. But I had shut down, and I became, at that point in childhood, a spiritual outlaw, is what I would call myself. Now, you know, Dr. John Mooney, do any of you know him? Would you mind raising your hand if you knew who I'm talking about? All right. He's one of my heroes in life. And Bill Wilson. They both agreed on something. That they had never, either one of them, met an alcoholic who was not searching for God and looking for him in a bottle. And I feel so sorry for God sometimes. Do you ever feel sorry for God? I mean, God tries so hard to get through to us. And that we would look for him that way. I mean, he's just trying and trying. God, further I go along, the more I think of God as being kind of like a lover who just keeps showing up and begging you and gets rejected by you and me over and over and over again. We say, no, I'll do it myself. No, I don't want anything to do with you. I mean, I don't know how he takes this. That'll be one of my questions one day. How did you put up with that much rejection? How could you stand it, you know? Well, I'm not up here to say any of these things caused my alcoholism, and I want to underline that with the red pen. None of these things I'm talking about today caused me to become an alcoholic. I know plenty of people whose daddies have died and mothers have died, and they didn't become alcoholic. They might have become obnoxious, but they did not become alcoholics. I know people who are so hooked on people pleasing, they'd walk all the way to the North Pole barefoot before they'd say no. And I know people who are so hooked on achievement, they spend their whole lives, you know, losing their health, really, to try to get wealthy, and then losing their wealth trying to get their health back. You know, and just... So that did not cause my alcoholism. I do believe, though, this morning that God wanted me to have sobriety and wanted me to work through these issues. And in order for me to ever work through this backlog stuff, I would probably have to get drunk and then come out the other side somewhere. And he wanted me to have sobriety. But before I tell you about what I think about sobriety, let me tell you something about my disease. And my disease spanned some time that, I was a late bloomer when it came to the disease. I mean by that I got all the way through high school without a drink. I married young now and became young. Young I was a mother, and then went and got 2 degrees before I ever went to seminary for the third one. I married a man who is a minister. It was the only thing I didn't like about him was the fact that he was a minister. And I thought it was pretty sneaky of God at the time, too, that he would be, you know, kind of coming and dealing with me that way. But he was kind of a campus minister, so that kept me out of having to be in some kind of situations, because he was a minister on the campus, and that provided me a little bit more room. But I wasn't drinking when I was dating. I never did have a date and drink. I didn't, I didn't develop this until later on. I became a very serious student and moaned and groaned with Camus and Sartre about how absurd the world was and stuff. I didn't go to school to eat my lunch. I felt like, you know, I gotta get the grades and do good, you know, and all this. So I was into achievement and took school very seriously. And it was when I became a supervising teacher for Indiana University in the field of history that and had gotten that kind of promotion, that I began to drink. And I began to drink in the evenings, I said, so I could sleep some. I could sleep better. I could relax more. I had tension. I had a sleep problem. And I think I'd always kind of fought sleep. Today, sleep is so delicious. I love it. You know, but then I was a fighter, and it was that going on in me, and I couldn't go to sleep. So I would feel like, well, I got to get 8 hours sleep. Let me have a little wine before I go to sleep. So I now know, though, because I know more about this disease and have tried to study it, that actually alcohol was causing the stress that I was drinking to relieve. And so I was already caught in the squirrel cage of alcoholism. But at the time, you know, the little epiphany I had, one evening a little light went on in my head, you know? And it was when I went into the kitchen and I was looking under the counter, looking for something, and realized that I had 65 Chianti bottles under the counter. And these were wine bottles that had, at the time, they were putting some kind of grass around them. And I thought, well, I'll decorate with that one day, you know. And, but what are you going to do with 65 Chianti bottles, you know? And it dawned on me. That was the moment that it dawned on me. Of course, I passed that by and didn't learn anything from it. But it dawned on me at that time that I might have a problem. And then I also... After teaching for a short time, I went into television. See, the teaching didn't do it for me, so I shifted again to try to think, oh, if I achieve something else through this. Became a talk show host. Now, back then, we did not have on television these programs like they have today, where they have topics like, he's not my grandson, he's my lover, and stuff like that. They have some weird talk show topics now. But back when I was doing it, it was a more mundane affair, and I was the midday lady for CBS affiliate. And so I did that talk show. Now, here's where my drinking picked up and shifted out of the wine mostly into booze. And I was really hooked on booze and into kind of a pedal to the metal lifestyle and really a pretty sick puppy. I did not drink when I was on the air. I would drink at night and in the afternoons and the evenings. And my amounts got up there too. But I would, my airtime, people said, was good. Impression management, you know, will get you far. But I was real sick off the air. And once something happened that, and it's on this hand, I became a blackout drinker. I was in Tallahassee once. Let me just tell what happened. I cut my hand severely in Tallahassee. I know I'd gone there to do a news story, but I don't know what was going on, but I cut my hand and I wound up in an emergency room. That young doctor was so tender and gentle with me. I can remember the expression on his face, and I can remember his concern, and he said, you know now, Jenny, you almost lost your thumb, or the use of your thumb. So now I got home, my wonderful husband, who was very worried about me, needless to say, you know, I went to him and I said, you know, I made up a story about how I cut my hand. In fact, I ended up making up several stories because, you know, when you're doing that kind of thing, you get confused about how I cut my hand. But the truth was, see, I don't know how I cut my hand. I don't know where I was. I don't know what was going on. And I can't imagine in the story that did take place and was finally aired, there wasn't anything that reminds me in that story that of the TV episode that I would have cut my hand in doing. I don't know what went on. And I mean, that was frightening. And so I sank into a very deep depression. Alcohol did not bring out much joy in me. I was really beginning to feel morose. I wrote this poetry. I love to write poetry sometimes when it just kind of comes every now and then. But I wrote terrible poems about my death and planned my funeral. And so I decided to go see a doctor. Now, here's where a shift, real shift, takes place. This doctor looked at me across his desk. He was real sharp, he had been to school. And he said, you're depressed. Then he followed that up with the most important part. He said, you know, you and I have to find out why you're depressed. And if we can find out why you're depressed, you see, your depression is a symptom of an underlying disorder. And if we can figure out why you're depressed, then we'll understand about the drinking and you won't need to drink so much, but you'll just drink like everybody else. And that sounded great to me. He and I worked on this thing. We excavated and dug around looking for the underlying cause of the reason I drank and stuff like this for a couple of years. You know, we messed around with that. And he worked at it hard, I worked at it hard. He was smart and I thought I was. And I mean, to tell you, we were like two broke guys trying to borrow a quarter from one another, you know, trying to find out why this was going on. And I wanted to do it because I wanted to drink like anybody else. And trying to find that thing. It's a wonder we didn't call the psychic network, really. We're looking for this thing. By the way, don't ever call them, folks. If they are really psychic, they'll know you're in trouble and they will call you. Right? But anyway, what happened with all that was, and I'm mad about this, and I'm still mad about it, because I believe that man knew, I believe he knew that I was an alcoholic. I told him how much I was drinking. I remember one day when I told him how much I'd consumed the evening before, he said, now you couldn't tolerate that much. I said, I didn't say I tolerated it. I said I drank it. And I believe he knew. And I did go back to him. I did go back to him as a sober person. And I went back in there and I told him, I said, look, I believe you knew I was an alcoholic all along, that what I needed to do was be confronted probably and go to AA. But you and me looking for this thing, and I have paid a bunch of bucks for this and still owe you money. And he dropped the bill right there. I had no attorney, nothing. I just passed that on to you. But I'm mad about this because I wonder how many people go undiagnosed by doctors. And I'll tell you, if you go in a doctor's office and the plants are dead, you get up and leave. Because that's a bad sign. That's a bad sign altogether. And well, after this, I pulled back and became a periodic. And if you've ever been a periodic, that's a rough thing to be. You know, I stopped my daily drinking and I went into another stage. And I pulled back and became this white-knuckled, hard to get along with, irritable, wretched periodic. And but the disease moved on, as the disease always does. You know, it moves inexorably on. There may be, and sometimes there were little let-ups, little lulls, little resting periods, maybe a plateau. Sometimes there even seemed to be a little improvement. But the disease moved on. The disease moved on. And I'll tell you, I believe the disease moves on in me even today, though I'm coming up on 16 years. I believe what Dr. John Mooney said about the disease is still moving on. And it's in your body, it's moving on. And if at this point you were to pick up a drink, you would not pick up where you left off, because the disease moves on. And I don't think anybody's body knows more than my body knows that this is a medical disease, that this is a physiological problem. And I remember it was like cellular meat hooks had a hold of my cells as this allergic craving was set up. And it is a physiological disease. And it was rough on everybody. I didn't understand why I was such a moral jellyfish. I just felt like, why do I weenie out, you know? I said I wasn't going to do this anymore. This is part of the pain of it, too. I said, why can't I be a good mother? I always had been a good mother, and now I'm just not really available to my wonderful son. And I'm not available to him in the way that I should be. Why can't I be a good mother? Why can't I be? You know, and the disease was moving on. And, of course, my husband and son were suffering a lot. I mean, when my personality potentials broke down, so did theirs. And every department of my being was just disintegrating. And we were disintegrating as a family. And we had one big rule, of course, and that was don't anybody say anything about it. And if somebody did ask me about it, I would scan their face for the slightest condescension, because my feelings were so raw and on edge to look at them. And well, two things were going for me this morning that I mentioned to you. And one was the grace of God that was softening me up for a surrender. And the other was a search party. You know, I believe that God sends out search parties, and you are many of the people that he sends out. But God sends out search parties to look for people when they get lost. And the wonderful thing about AA search parties is they don't care if they look stupid. They don't care if they feel awkward. They don't care if they have to go into strange places to find you. They're not more concerned about their public image than they are about what's right and what needs to be done. And they come and get you, and they won't let you rest till you give yourself up. They're great. They're some of God's most useful search parties, and he sent out a search party looking for me. And well, the first thing that happened was I had a wreck. We have these wrecks, you know, and I know we do. This one was a monumental. Thank goodness it's a single car. I hit a telephone pole, went over four times, crawled out through the side of the car, and I'm scratch on me. But it was a wreck, man. I heard a guy in a meeting say one night, if you don't say anything about my drive, way I drive, if you don't like it, get off the sidewalk, stuff like this. We have a lot of wrecks, but this was a key wreck, and it got my attention. So in 1980, I went to detox. And that's where the first, and it was grace that got me there. I don't think that we get there any other way when we actually elect to do that. I mean, I was getting so tired. I was just tired, you know? You know, this is not as much fun as it's cracked up to be a drunk. And it's such hard work, and I was getting weary, and that's grace, really, that I think gets you weary. It's like Jim Hightower from Texas, the old agricultural commissioner, used to say, they promise you a seven-course meal, but what you wind up with is a possum and a six-pack, you know? And it was getting hard for me. And so I began to get weary, and I asked to go to detox, and I didn't let anybody else know I was going but my husband and son. But I mean, we packed the car for 2 weeks, and I just showed up at the Medical College of Georgia in Augusta on a doctor's steps and just went in there, and I said, let me tell you, I want to go through detox. I want you to detox me. Can you do that? And he just kind of looked at me and said, well, anybody that knows his pharmaceuticals can take you through that. I said, well, I don't want it on my insurance. I don't want anybody to know about this. Please don't put it on my insurance. I want a private room. I don't want to be around anybody. I'm not there to make friends, please. I don't want to be around any alcoholics or crazy people. And I just want a room and a place to go through this. It's a job, and I'm going to get this job done. And of course, it was like a washing machine had been turned on when I got in there and went through that process. But it got rugged in there, but God came in that room. And that was the start for me, because I knew there was a presence there. And I remember, really, my first thing that happened to me was I sat on the bed and laughed out loud and thought, wow. Because I couldn't have been more unachieving. I couldn't have been less perfect or people-pleasing. And here I was in a terrible predicament, and I felt God's love for me. And I thought, this is God. This is the God I've been running from. The joke is on me. You know, and I just laughed out loud. And something started there for me. I began to talk to God. I began to talk to God the way I hope you do, emotionally honest, where you just name it. You just talk to Him. And you develop a conscious contact, and you practice His presence by just talking to Him like you talk to anybody. And I talked to Him just like a little bitty kid, which I was a little bitty kid in spiritually in many ways. And I would just say, thank you so much for being here. I just hope you'll be here in the morning when I wake up. I love you so much. It's great to get to know you. Just hang around with me and help me, okay? And I would just talk to Him like that. And something began to happen. But it was going to take the search party, really, to bring me in. Because even that is not enough. We need a program, and I couldn't invent one. And so what happened in my life that was very pivotal was that in 1982, about this time of year, I went to a conference that was sponsored by Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. And it was called Alcoholism, the Cost to the Community. And I went to that conference. I went to the conference as an intellectual observer. That's what I was trying to look like. Who was there to really try to catch on to what I thought alcoholism was, learn more about the disease, and then proceed to work some kind of a program that could keep me sober. I'd had my start in 80, but that's why I don't count my sobriety until 82, really, because this is when all this happened to me. And I think real sobriety is more than just not drinking. And so I was in that room. I remember Dr. Al Mooney spoke, and he gave a very good lecture, and I enjoyed that. But then later on that night, I came back because the nighttime, this was all happening at Georgia Southern University there, which was then called college. But at night, they offered a variety of things that people could take, you know, for the evening session. They had a film, they had someone doing an intervention. I think it might have been Ed Pierce, who's so brilliant at that film. They had all kinds of, you know, kind of a thing for the family, this kind of thing. And then they had a mock AA meeting, a pretend AA meeting would take place. I said, here is my chance. And so, friends, I signed up for the mock AA meeting. And do you know that there were 300 people at that conference, and I am the only person that signed up for a pretend AA meeting? And I walked in that room. It was one of the classrooms at Georgia Southern, and nobody was there. And I stayed in there about 10 minutes by myself, and then a man walked in, and I'm before and after his walking in this morning. A man called C.D. Collins walked in that room. Raise your hand if you know him. He has over 40 years sobriety, I think. And C.D. came in, and C.D. started talking to me. And he started saying things to me. It was so warm, like an embrace, just to talk to me, you know. And so when the conversational waters appeared kind of safer, I ventured out a little bit, and I said, you know, C.D., I had a problem once with alcohol myself, once. And C.D. said, well, maybe you're kind of like Ida. And he began to talk about his wife and said, maybe it was kind of hard for her to identify herself as an alcoholic at first. Maybe you're sort of like she is. And we talked and talked. Finally, I said, you know, C.D., I really appreciate you just spending your time with me, and I have really enjoyed this. And it looks like nobody's coming, though, so I'll just go on home and come back in the morning. No, he said, they're having a meeting. They're having a meeting. They just, I'm sure they all must have gone to the wrong room or something. Now, you just sit right here because they're coming. They're coming. And don't go anywhere now. And he walked out of the room. Beloved, I now know that C.D. Collins left that room and went and cleared out a couple of halfway houses. C.D. made me a meeting. Can you imagine that kind of love? C.D. made me a meeting. That just amazes me. That's called amazing grace. And he went out, and I mean, these people that started coming in, they were an assortment of folks too. They were really a variety, and some of them were still in the throes of detox. And, one guy got up and spoke. Well, first, before the speaking took place, C.D. looked at me and he said, he turned to the group coming in. He said, I want y'all to meet Jenny Jackson, Adam. She's an alcoholic. I said, I pulled him off the side. I said, C.D., nobody's ever said that about me in public. He said, sit down. It's going to be fine. And so Dr. C. Duncan Cater got up to speak. And his knees were knocking. He was a medical doctor, and he was a graduate of Emory University Med School, had a brilliant career in medicine, and he had gotten sick from this stuff. And I mean, he was still just beginning to recover, and his knees were knocking, and he was just looked terrible, you know. And if he had been on a lot of stuff. If it ended in IUM or RAL, he had been taking it, you know, because he could write his own stuff. And then Dr. Charlie got up and spoke, and I was identifying with Clint, Dr. Cater the whole way through. I was identifying with him, and I had never felt like I did in that room. I'd never in my life felt that way. And at the end of the meeting, you know, we closed with the Lord's Prayer, and I got in my car and drove out into the night and went home, and my family was seated in the den as I walked in the door that day and that night, and I walked right past them. I didn't say anything to them. I remember I walked right past them, I walked down the hallway, and I walked back to the back bathroom, and I looked in the mirror and stared at myself and said, "I'm Jenny Jackson Adams, and I'm an alcoholic." And the tears just came up all the way from my toes. And so that's where it starts for me. And that's why I believe I'm sober today, because of the wonderful things that people have done for me. And so I would set my day at December 26, 1982. And I want to thank C.D. Collins, who isn't here this morning, but I thank him from the bottom of my heart for being what Sam Shoemaker called a person who would stand by the door. There are a lot of you who stand by the door. And Bill Wilson, in his 25th anniversary address of the 25th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous, credited him so much for the design of AA, which then also came out of the Oxford movement, which I'm very proud was also partly Methodist. But in any case, we need people who stand by the door. And C.D. was there for me, and Dr. Cato was. He became, after seminary, became senior chaplain of Drew University and served some churches in New Jersey before I came home to Georgia, and have served churches here. And the church has given me all kinds of opportunities, really, to speak in Portland and Los Angeles and Duke University and Orlando and Harrisburg, St. Louis, Houston. Just opened up a lot of opportunities for me that I would never have believed that could have taken place if it hadn't been for the gift of sobriety. I want to just say a couple of things in closing about what sobriety means to me. And I think sobriety means to me that let me just run through a couple of things. It means that I can lighten up. My son told me once, he said, "Mom, those AAs really laugh a lot, and you do too." And remember that deadly and serious always go together. You know, and we need to lighten up. The scientists say if you do not laugh when you feel that urge, that it will come inside you and reverse itself and spread your hips out. So that's pretty crucial. And it's important to laugh. And this program gives that to us, an ability to lighten up and sit looser in the saddle. And another book, which Lynn Sweet translates, Jesus is saying, there will be no grown-ups in heaven because we will need to lighten up. It means that I can make priorities in my life. I'm not a disease. I have had a disease and have a disease that still moves inexorably on, from whom I have this miraculous recovery. And it ill behooves me to ever be cocky about that, because we get our sobriety a day at a time. But because of the release from the throes of this disease, I can order priorities, and I can go ahead with my life and do some things and take care of myself. And you know, your body is the only place you have to live, so you have to take care of yourself. Sobriety means that I can say that all things work for good for those who love God. And that doesn't mean everything is fun, you know, or everything that happens is fun, but it does mean that it all works for good. Even when you come to the end of your answers, why some things are happening. It's when you get to the end of your answers that you find out what kind of God you really do have, isn't it? I can let go of resentments today, not let people just live in my head rent-free. And you know, forgiveness is for you, and I know you know this. When we really need to relieve revenge to our higher power, and let go of this. And as someone said, you know, always forgive your enemies. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said that nothing annoys them so much as you forgiving them. Just let it go. And it's amazing what happens then. I also don't have to crucify myself between regret over what happened yesterday and fear of the future. And that's the way most people do. You know, I was with someone to hear them go through the process of dying and anointed them and prayed with them at Mayo St. Luke Hospital in Jacksonville the other day. And it just strikes me over and over again, you know, that really time heals the things that we regret that we did in the past. But it's those things that you don't do that you wish you had done that are going to drive you nuts. So go ahead and take your opportunities as they're presented to you. And be like the fellow that they said in Savannah feeds the pigeons every morning and goes down and feeds 2,000 pigeons with a big smile on his face. And most people think he's a bird lover, but really, he's a dry cleaner. And take your opportunities when you see them, okay? I think God wonders why we settle for so little and just lie there on the couch and watch Vanna turn the next letter when we could be doing so many things. Sobriety means that, it means sanctity. And that's a spiritual word, sanctity. But all it really means is set aside special. If I feel special and I value myself. And I say that because I used to, when a tray of drinks would go by, I would feel resentment. For a couple of years, I did. I really felt like you were having something that I don't get to have. And I really envied and resented. And it was a bad feeling. Envy is the worst feeling you can have, you know. But I don't do that anymore. Now I feel, when I see a tray of drinks go by, I feel special. And I feel like I don't drink. I don't drink, and I don't have to. And I don't have to mess up my mind, and I can use my gifts. And I don't drink, and I'm very special, and I'm very valuable. And, you know, some people don't want you to be special. Have you noticed that? But go ahead and be special. It is a special thing. And I think we need to go ahead and take hold of that. And it also means that I'm not missing anything. You know, alcohol does not improve your thinking. I think it was Jay Leno, and by the way, Jay does not drink, not because he's one of us, but because he doesn't choose to drink. But I remember one time he said that they said scientifically that moderate amounts of alcohol would improve your thinking, but he rather thought it was large amounts that improve it, because then you start thinking, where is my car? Why is my head in the toilet? Who are these people? You know, alcohol really does not improve people's lives all that much. It doesn't improve conversation. I go to cocktail parties sometimes today, and I can do that through the grace of God and just drink tonic water. I'll never get malaria ever. I've had so much of that now. But you know, because I think it just really makes people, rather than improving it, it makes people just satisfied with any conversation they get. Well, anyway, sobriety means for me that I can take responsibility for my thoughts and own those thoughts and not push them off on other people. You know, and I don't believe in the pop-in theory. I think that if you are having thoughts, they're your thoughts. If they're not yours, let's get the guy in here who's thinking them and we'll work with him. They're your thoughts. And you become a victim when you don't take responsibility for your own thoughts and your own life. And I can feel like I can do that today. The first 5 years of my recovery were so rugged that I look back on that. I believe with Ernie Larson that it does take somewhere between 2 and 5 years to recover. And I believe him on that. I would think, well, I'm okay now, you know, and then I would just come up on this wall. It was like shoveling rocks, as he puts it. It was like turning around an ocean liner, you know, to get me to turn around. And after the first 5 years, I have felt more free, but I still, of course, have to come back and work on things. And but those first 5 years were rugged, and I'm so glad. You know, if somebody, nobody can give that to you. And so if they could give you self-respect and they could give you sobriety, you wouldn't know what to do with it anyway, because you'd be too weak to use it. That comes out of that work. So I challenge you to keep it up, because it's worth it in the long run. Sobriety means I can go to sleep. I say the same prayer every night. I drift off to sleep saying that prayer, recognizing that I'm a sinner, and recognizing that He will pray for me even as I sleep, and I can just turn my problems over to Him, because He's going to be up all night, and go to sleep, and sleep is wonderful. Sobriety means giving up the ghost of me having to explain myself all the time, and that's a real snore that I used to go through, having to explain myself. It's like the guy that dropped water in his lap once, and so, you know, no matter how he explained it, everybody kept their own version of what had happened. So you don't have to explain yourself. Sobriety means that I can accept God as a parent and get to know God, and it means that I can throw my fantasies out and really work on goals. I have people come in my office that I begin to realize really have a fantasy and not a goal. If you got fantasies this morning, you won't work on a fantasy. You will not work on a fantasy. Dump those out of the suitcase and just take the goals with you and trim down. Because go ahead and face it, you're not going to do it if it's a fantasy. You're not going to work on it. And you know somewhere it is. And here's, as I conclude, let me tell you this. Sobriety means for me that I can do my best to try to honor. Honor is an old-fashioned word. We need to resurrect that word, honor. We're dying from a lack of it, I think. But I can honor those people who have invested in me and been a base support for me. I can try to honor Dot Mooney and the times that she has spent with me as my first sponsor, and then on later on when she has continued to be. And I called her about coming here. She said, I think you need to do this. I think you need to do it. I can try to honor C.D. Collins. I can honor those people like D.B. Browning. Does anyone here know him? All right. D.B. was... I baptized D.B. and had the privilege of being with him when he died and burying him. But D.B. used to say, all you need to know about God is there is one and you're not it. I can try to let my life honor him and honor Phyllis Zarda, who was my sponsor and my great friend and gave me a rock that I still keep by my bed that says, be still. So I can know. I can try to honor Dr. John Mooney, who was my hero and who helped so many of us to get well. And I would like to say about Dr. Duncan Cater this morning, who has beat us home to the Father's house. He died in June. It was just about a month before that we learned he had pancreatic cancer. Dr. Clinton Duncan Cater named 3 streets in Perry, Georgia, when he was a little boy. In his great wisdom, he named 1 Clinton, 1 Duncan, and 1 Cater. And he grew up and was a medical doctor, and I don't know how many of you that he may have influenced. I know at his funeral they said that he had changed addiction medicine in Tennessee, and he had locked horns with some of the doctors who spoke that day to give him credit for the fact that if he hadn't locked horns with them and fought for us, that they wouldn't have changed their opinions. And I think he needs to be credited for that. Duncan was never a very good politician, but he was kind of like a bull in a china shop sometimes. But it was one of the things I loved about him, because it didn't matter which way the winds blew. If he loved you, he loved you. And he was like a brother to me. Every week he called me with some crazy thing on the answering machine or talking to me and lifting me up. And I owe so much to him, and I miss him so terribly. I banged on the doors of heaven for his life when we began to realize that he might not be here long. He was fine. He told me, he said, you know, I finished my job. And well done, good and faithful servant. He had finished his job. He said, you haven't finished yours yet. But I banged on the doors of heaven because I don't believe if it's God's will, healing. I don't believe that. I believe the Bible's take it seriously that we're to pray for healing. We'll either get it here or on the other side, but we'll get healed one way or the other. But we're to pray for that. And so I prayed for it. And I would like to lead you this morning in doing something, because I know that there are people I do not even know from your life that you missed this morning, that have been in your lives that you honored that have died. And I would like for Duncan Cater, MD, and for these other people to be honored. If we could just have just a moment of silence, and just a moment of silence for you to do that and for me to do that. Amen. You know, Duncan never asked, why me? But he did ask one question over and over again of me. What's next? What's next? And he was ready for what was next. Beloved, let's keep giving this program away. I'm here because of the people who gave it away to me. That's the only reason I'm here, through God's grace, and the only reason I would be sober to talk to you this morning. Some people get cirrhosis of the giver, and they won't give. And of course, they can't keep it because they won't give it. The secret is to remember where you came from and how much you don't want to go back there, and then to give it away. You know, Ronnie Van Zant, and I may be the only minister who has a framed picture of Ronnie Van Zant. But Ronnie Van Zant, as he used to barefoot stalk the stage, he sang a song that I loved so much, Free Bird. And there was a line in there, if I leave here tomorrow, will you still remember me? Yes, we will remember you, Duncan. Yes, we will remember all of you and how much you gave. It's been great to be here with you today. Please remember me in your prayers. God loves you, and so do I.